The following program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. It's the Indie Week newspaper. From the North Carolina Reading Service, I am John Federson, reading our latest issue, and it's dated September the 9th, 2020. And who's receiving our thanks for performing our theme music today? Well, my notes say it's the Montana State University Balloon Choir. Some 22 musicians who inflate balloons and let the air squeak out to achieve spectacular musical effect. Thank you, MSUBC. We'll listen for you at the end of our broadcast today. And here we go. Our first column is Voices, and this is by Courtney Napier this week. A Raleigh native, community activist, and co-host of a podcast, Mothering on the Margins. The Raleigh Affordable Housing Bond is the last item on the November 2020 ballot, but for many on the brink of homelessness, it is the most important. There's potential for real, equitable change to occur in our capital city. There is opportunity for Raleigh to be an example to the country of finding creative solutions to difficult challenges related to displacement, gentrification, and homelessness. But up to this point, Raleigh has chosen profit over innovation, and the housing bond feels like deja vu. The bond is currently a blank check with a wish list of five areas of desired spending: land acquisition, owner-occupied home rehabilitation, down payment assistance, private-public partnerships, and low-income housing tax credit gap financing. I am the first to admit that the housing crisis Raleigh faces is daunting. But my concern is that instead of facing it, city leadership is attempting to redefine it. It is well documented that Raleigh has an ever-increasing homelessness issue. Hotels across the city are occupied almost exclusively by unhoused people. Local shelters are struggling under the weight of the need for shelter and the demands of safety in the age of COVID-19. You can't begin to measure this phenomenon with the area median income. The area in the AMI actually accounts for Raleigh and Cary, which renders it useless for measuring Raleigh's housing needs. Also, if they're making anything at all, our homeless residents make below minimum wage. Since a large portion of them are single mothers and schools are closed, many parents have to make the tough decision of leaving jobs to attend to their children, according to Housing and Neighborhoods Director Larry Jarvis. There are nearly 5,000 people on the waiting list for Section 8 housing assistance vouchers. These vouchers allow a family to pay a portion of their rent, while HUD pays the rest, essentially allowing landlords to earn the market rate while housing low-income families. But in North Carolina, landlords can choose not to accept a Section 8 voucher, and many are opting out. Only a small percentage of voucher holders find housing before their benefit expires. Instead of making the housing bond about this issue, the city has decided to redefine our housing crisis. Instead of making the goal to house the unhoused, the new definition of the crisis is that there aren't enough units on the market for entry-level buyers. This redirection effort explains why the building and development community is campaigning for the bond to pass. Local construction companies, architects, design firms, nonprofits, real estate professionals, and even one of Raleigh's former mayors have all used their voices, influence, and wealth to encourage Raleigh to vote yes. Jarvis made it clear to City Council last week that focusing on building units at 30% of Raleigh's AMI would mean far fewer units can be built overall. More units overall, the council argued, is much more important than building as many units for the most vulnerable as possible. It seems like Raleigh builders and developers completely agree, and they stand to make a ton of money if the bond passes. But what will happen to those who won't find affordable housing in this plan? What will happen to those who will be displaced while the city goes on its land acquisition shopping spree through our most vulnerable communities? And as Raleigh welcomes more and more families fleeing natural and unnatural disasters, what will happen to those who can't compete with their cash offers? Raleigh's affordable housing bond has been publicized as creating more housing options for all, which translates to, if you aren't lucky enough to get into one of the few low-income units we choose to build, here are some lovely shelters we can direct you to until you find a place outside the city limits. Down-ballot voting is one of the most potent tools we have to effect real change in our community. When too many Raleigh residents are unhoused and many more are on the brink, it is not the time to redefine this crisis in a way that wins the support of the building and development class. If Raleigh wants to use this critical point in our country's history to make change in housing, then it must center those with the greatest need. Otherwise, it's a waste of taxpayer dollars. When the at-large council member Nicole Stewart said that the city isn't in the business of helping residents build wealth, that should apply to the millionaires, too. And now we go right into our news columns. Tomasi McDonald here from Durham. Food fight. Essential workers shut down a Freddy's frozen custard and steak burgers in West Durham on Friday when they walked off the job to demand a safer workplace after reports of a fellow employee testing positive for the coronavirus. The protest and strike, which took place September 4th at the fast food restaurant just off U.S. 501, follows a similar event at an East Raleigh Bojangles last month when an employee there also tested positive for the virus. Employees at both locations have accused the restaurants of violating federal laws that protect workers' wages under quarantine after they may have been exposed to the virus. It was just after noon when Jamila Allen, who works at the Freddy's on Watkins Road, led her co-workers out of the restaurant. They were joined by nearly 60 supporters, including evening shift workers. The workers chanted and demonstrated for just over an hour, but the day-long strike prompted the business to close for the rest of the day before reopening Saturday morning. Some of the workers and their supporters held aloft signs that read, "Hazardous work deserves hazard pay," and Freddy's, "Protect your workers and unions for all." And Allen, an NC Raise Up and Fight for $15 later, told the crowd through a megaphone, "This COVID case shows why workers need to be involved in the decisions Freddy's makes about our safety, why we need a union. This is what a union looks like, workers talking to each other, standing up together and having each other's backs. We're going to keep acting like a union while we fight for our demands and our union rights." The walkout was preceded by the workers delivering strike notices to the restaurant's management team, according to a press statement by the NC Raise Up Fight for $15. The workers are demanding a hazard pay increase of $5 an hour for all employees, or a total hourly rate of $15 per hour, whichever is higher. They're also calling for immediate compensation for workers who missed shifts due to a COVID-19 quarantine mandate, in accordance with the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, FFCRA, which requires certain employees to provide paid sick leave or expanded family and medical leave for reasons related to COVID. The FFCRA is effective until December 31st. It was on August 9th when Freddy's management staff notified 12 workers that a fellow employee had tested positive for the virus, which has killed 86 people in Durham County, 210 in Wake, and 2,897 across the state. Freddy's mandated the workers to quarantine for 2 weeks or until they could provide proof of negative COVID-19 test results. The striking workers say Freddy's did not pay them while they were quarantined, even though employees are entitled to up to 80 hours of paid sick leave under the FFCRA, which was enacted to address their exact situation, according to the statement. The workers say the store was never shut down, and they doubt that a proper professional COVID cleaning ever took place. Days before Friday's strike, the workers delivered a petition to management that had been signed by 19 employees. Quote, "We have been working throughout this pandemic, risking our own health and safety to keep Freddy's open and running smoothly. We deserve to be compensated fairly for hazards we face every day at work. In Friday's statement, the workers said that when management failed to respond to the petition, they decided to strike. The inaction left the workers, who have been deemed essential during the pandemic, feeling disposable. Precious Cole, one of the striking employees, says the way that Freddy's has handled this COVID case, they have shown they only care about money. But today we showed Freddy's that we are united as workers, and we are powerful. Now, the Indy called Freddy's the day after the strike and protest to ask if management intended to honor the workers' demands. That's funny, a man who identified himself as the store manager says. He also said to call the restaurant's chain corporate office, but refused to disclose the phone number. You can go online and get it, he said. The Wichita, Kansas-based restaurant chain has about 300 locations across the United States. Company officials could not be reached for immediate comment. 2 weeks before the walkout and strike at Freddy's, workers at the Bojangles on New Bern Avenue in Raleigh accused the restaurant managers of mishandling a COVID-19 case at the store. Rumors of the positive test began to circulate among the employees on August 3rd. According to a press statement from NC Raise Up Fight for $15, when the workers asked whether an employee had tested positive, Bojangles management denied the information, assuring workers that no store employees had the virus. 5 days later, two Bojangles workers, Lamika Moses and Lisa Foster, saw a notification pinned to a rarely read bulletin board in the back of the store, notifying employees that a co-worker had in fact tested positive for COVID-19. Moses and Foster walked off the job and went on strike. They were joined on strike by Foster's son, Dikembe Black, who was scheduled to work the night shift. On August 19th, the three striking workers and their supporters delivered official strike notices and demands to the restaurant, saying that workers were not properly notified, nor was the store professionally cleaned. Like Freddy's employees, Bojangles workers want to be paid for the self-quarantine. In addition, they demanded that it should be made available for all workers who were potentially exposed to the virus. The workers reported that the restaurant, before posting the notice, asked three employees to quarantine and paid them, but has refused to pay other employees who work in what is described as a small kitchen where it's difficult to practice social distancing. They also say the store should be professionally cleaned with proof of the cleaning shared with employees and the public. And along with demands for a pay increase to $15 an hour for all workers, the striking employees say they have not received hazard pay that was promised to them by the restaurant chain. Moses, a longtime fast food worker and the mother of three young girls, says Bojangles does not have employees' best interest at heart. All workers should have been notified immediately, but there was no real communication from Bojangles. They posted the notice several days too late and in a place where they knew most employees would never see it. They just wanted us to keep working. At the onset of the pandemic, Foster said the restaurant handed out T-shirts to employees that read, "Risk it for the biscuit." The items are also on sale to the public. Foster says, "It may be a joke to them, but for workers like me who are risking our lives to come to work every day is no joke." She remained on strike Saturday with Moses and her son until their demands are met. "We make Bojangles millions of dollars, and they didn't even care enough to make sure our store got properly cleaned to protect us from this COVID outbreak." All right, Mary King now gives us some news from Orange County. Join the club. Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools are operating online this semester, which means their student LGBTQ organizations are too. Clubs such as the Queer Straight Alliance are important outlets for students to discuss their experiences without fear of discrimination, says Chapel Hill High School Junior and QSA President Grace Davis, who notes the relatively high rate of suicide and depression among LGBTQ youths. In clubs, they can freely talk about the issues they face, whether it's homophobic bullying or a teacher who won't respect their pronouns. While virtual schooling presents challenges for all students, they can be especially grave for some LGBTQ students, such as those who must spend long days in unaccepting households. They're also deprived of the simple joys of in-person interactions with LGBTQ peers, such as rummaging through the rainbow buckets of candy in the Mix Reinholz's room during QSA meetings at Chapel Hill High School. It's really just to give them a place to talk about those issues and feel accepted and loved, even if they aren't in other areas of the school and even at home, Davis says. Before the pandemic, the QSA hung posters in the school displaying mental health resources and hotlines. But then COVID derailed some of the group's other activist endeavors, like a bake sale Davis had hoped to hold in support of the Orange County Rape Crisis Center. For the virtual semester, the QSA is eschewing much of an outreach agenda in favor of internal community building via online meetings and a group chat where members can exchange memes and talk about what's going on for them. Davis says our main thing is to just meet and try and play a game or talk about what's going on in online school, to just kind of have fun for a minute and get our mind off things that are not going so well. McDougal Middle School's Gender and Sexuality Alliance was also engaging in activism before the pandemic, said 7th grade English language arts teacher and GSA advisor Seth Gillis. The GSA had participated in a book drive for Book Harvest to help ensure that some of the donated books included queer representation. Gillis says the GSA is an essential safe space for youth who are questioning their identity or identify as queer. He's seen it make an impact. As a teacher, he's observed that members feel more comfortable bringing things that the GSA discusses into the classroom. I think that my relationship with schooling would have been much different if I had had this opportunity or this space when I was in school, he says. COVID-19 largely halted the GSA's activities last semester, but Gillis hopes that with a more consistent school schedule this fall, students will be able to maintain the club remotely. Gillis says GSA advisors try to keep the group as student-centered as possible, so the students will determine what they think is necessary for their community in a virtual setting. He says, the thing I'm worried most about is whether or not some of our kids are going to feel safe at home being a part of the meeting. So I'm looking at a lot of different ways of how they can be involved just using the chat feature. After months in quarantine and with a semester of online schooling ahead, some LGBTQ youth are stuck at home with family members who don't affirm their identities, and a lack of privacy could make it difficult for them to fully participate in virtual LGBTQ groups. Chapel Hill High School online learning facilitator and QSA advisor Danny Reinholz says, that's the kind of stuff that keeps me up at night. I want to make sure that their names and pronouns are respected and also that they're not inadvertently outed at home, if they're not out at home. Although virtual learning can impose burdens on LGBTQ youth, it can also make some aspects of life easier. For example, Davis says, students no longer have to deal with encounters in the hallway between classes, where most bullying happens. She says, you can create a place like our group chat where you can only have the people that support you instead of just everyone that's at the school. Virtual meetings might even lead some students to feel more comfortable participating in GSA. She says, if this is going to be a safe haven for at least one student who maybe feels more comfortable getting involved virtually, then that's a win in itself. Reinholz says that to support the work of LGBTQ student groups, people should take care to use LGBTQ kids' chosen names and pronouns. They say, that's really what I want from the school, to treat these kids with respect and actually get to know them. Asked what the broader community can do to support the QSA, Davis says, as a parent of a student who's not part of the LGBTQ community or is not out, I think it would do a lot to help to just open your mind and educate yourself on LGBTQ issues and just always be aware that not everyone is who they are on paper. next from Indie Week. Sarah Edwards pens the cover story, A People's History of Country Music. The country musician, Reese Palmer, settles into a chair in her Durham studio. Behind her is a blackboard where she has scrawled to-do lists, a Quincy Jones quote, and her three-month goals. She's such an enthralling presence, intent, gracious, and assertive, that it takes me a moment to notice the tiny hand reaching up from the bottom of the Zoom frame to tug her hair. It's Nova, her baby daughter, whom she's nursing while effortlessly rattling off country music deep cuts. She's equally unfazed when her husband, Brian, and her dog wander in and out of the frame. Reese Palmer can do it all. Mommy could be doing the most important things in the whole world, and it still doesn't matter, Palmer says with a smile and a shrug. It's September the 3rd, a few days after the release of the first episode of Color Me Country, Palmer's new Apple podcast, which focuses on the Black, Indigenous, and Latinx histories of country music. The name comes from Palmer's patron saint, Linda Martell, a country singer who, in 1969, became the first Black woman to sing at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. Palmer says, I was nervous because this really is a really important project to me. When it's an album, you can be like, well, I don't care because I love it. But with this, it's really important for me to get it right because it's not just my story. This is a lot of people's story. The task of telling the alternative history of country music is a big one, in part because so little information about it exists. Google pulls up a handful of think pieces, many of them born during the Lil Nas X media frenzy, when his hooky TikTok sensation Old Town Road topped the country charts before being removed by Billboard for not being country enough. In the wake of that controversy, listicles about Black country artists sprang up along pieces that framed artists of color in relation to their influence on the genre, which, since country originated in Black traditions, are many. Still, the commercial side of the genre is unfriendly to Black artists and listeners, with a charged history of erasing that influence, seldom signing artists of color, and keeping them off the radio. When Black country stars have managed to break these barriers, they rarely receive the standard Nashville treatment or receive the recognition they've earned. This is where Color Me Country comes in, with a debut season that focuses exclusively on women. Palmer says, it's really important to me to normalize this for these women to become part of the conversation, not just in an other kind of way. In the same breath that you talk about Kelsey Ballerini, you should be talking about Miko Marks. The first woman we get to know in the first episode of Color Me Country is Palmer. We learn of her influences from Lionel Richie to Patti Griffin and hear from her close circle, her best friend, her husband, her 9-year-old daughter, in an intimate look at Palmer's journey to Nashville. There, with Country Girl in 2007, she became the first Black artist in 20 years to chart a country single. Palmer was born and raised outside of Pittsburgh. At age 12, she moved with her family to Missouri, where she consumed a steady radio diet of pop and hip-hop. She was obsessed with Mariah Carey, Britney Spears, and the Backstreet Boys. But her Georgia-born parents loved country music, and she did too. She said, I didn't feel like I could say out loud I like country because I felt like a lot of my friends would look at me crazy. Girl, you like country? So I didn't tell a lot of people that that's what I was listening to. I would pull into a school listening to Tupac, and really, a few minutes before, I was listening to Trisha Yearwood. From a young age, Palmer knew she wanted to sing. At 16, she busted out Shania Twain's Any Man of Mine on a chicken shit-littered Arkansas State Fair stage. A few years later, she dropped out of DePaul University in Chicago to pursue music, and at age 19, she was offered a shot at R&B stardom when the producers Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, a duo that has worked with the likes of Janet Jackson and Palmer's idol Mariah Carey, offered her a record deal on Flight Time Records. But she turned it down. The sound wasn't her. when Palmer was 21, a Star Search rep came out across a performance by her, and she went on to place third in the 2003 season of the talent show. Things picked up speed from there. She signed with the label 1720 Entertainment, and in 2007 released her self-titled debut album, which featured the clear-eyed, joyful single Country Girl, which peaked at number 54 on the country music charts. It was followed by two more Billboard Hot Country songs, Hold On To Me, which reached number 59 in May of 2008, and a cover of Jordan Sparks' No Air, which peaked at 47 a month later. Palmer also achieved another dream, following in Linda Martell's footsteps when she sang at the Grand Ole Opry in 2007. But Nashville music is a tough business, especially for a black woman, and artistic differences led her to leave her label in 2009. A decision that turned into a legal dispute and prevented Palmer from recording for a year. She's continued to release albums, though none have replicated the chart success of her early singles. In 2013, after having her first child, Grace, she released the children's album Best Day Ever, followed by a five-song EP, The Back Porch Sessions, in 2015, and Revival in 2019. Palmer's career has taken her to New York, Los Angeles, Nashville, and finally Durham, where she lives with her husband and two daughters. About 500 miles from Nashville, she's found true kinship with musicians like Phil Cook and Zozak's Keenan Jenkins. It's not like Los Angeles. It's not like New York, Palmer says. This is a true community. You can reach out and touch these people. Kamara Thomas, who runs the Country Soul Songbook series, which highlights alternative voices in country, soul, and Americana, says she and Palmer are each other's biggest fans. Thomas says our aims are so similar in that we care about the music. We're willing to put our action behind the change we want to see within it. Jenkins says, I try to make sure I have the same drive and passion for my work that I've seen in her, because I know that's what gets artists through setbacks. She's obviously a trailblazer for black women in country music, but she's a guidepost for me as well. Since Palmer's 2007 hit, there have been other songs with the same title, from Luke Bryan's Too Cheesy to Be Sleazy tailgate anthem, which includes that infamous parenthetical wink, Country Girl, Shake It For Me, to the Carolina Chocolate Drop's defiant portrait of a backwoods southern woman. And there were others before Palmer who certainly didn't invent the phrase, but she did reinvent it. As her hit single has it, being a country girl isn't about a dress code or zip code or race. It's not being a Georgia peach or Tennessee 10. It's about heartbreak and bare feet and true love and tire swings, appreciating the small things and honoring your roots. That's being a country girl, and that's country music. Originally, Palmer had planned to release the podcast on June 29th during the National Black Lives Matter protests, but then a week before the release, she checked her email to find a message from Apple. They'd heard about her podcast, and they wanted to hear more. Over the summer, the entertainment industry has taken a hard look in the mirror and made some promising gestures towards racial equity. Reese Witherspoon announced the production of a country music talent show that will focus on diversity. Faith Hill and Charlie Worsham avowed support for Mississippi removing Confederate iconography from its state flag. The Dixie Chicks scrambled to drop Dixie from their name, followed by Lady Antebellum become Lady A, and swiftly blundering into a messy $10 million lawsuit with a black blues singer of the same name. But it's a tough industry to reform overnight. Whiteness is the bedrock of commercial country music, where blues roots have been systematically whitewashed over time, replaced with anthems that sell jingoism, xenophobia, and large, expensive trucks. In a recent interview with Rolling Stone, Rhiannon Giddens was blunt about why more people don't know about country music's diverse roots. Quote, white supremacy. There's no other way to put it. It was constructed by numerous people as part of the white supremacy movement. Is a tide really turning in country music? Ask me in a year, Palmer says. She's less concerned with performative allyship that directs attention to the growth of white artists than with directing attention to the artists of color that are already out there doing the work and singing the songs. Kamara Thomas says, we're advocating for our daughters being able to show up into a creative space and be defined for just what they're bringing. I think part of what Color Me Country is trying to do is carve out those spaces where it's like, you just come here to be an artist. Season 1, focus on women is appropriate, as country music has both race and gender problems, doubling the challenges for women of color. The next episode, which comes out September the 13th, will feature a conversation with Miko Marks, a husky-voiced country singer who has received critical acclaim and comparison to Winona Judd, but has yet to break through the charts or major market station. The podcast takes its name from the Linda Martell album that turned 50 this year, which was released by a label that was in gutting proof of the industry's racism, called Plantation Records. Martell has been a shadowy figure for years. It was known that she lived somewhere in South Carolina, but that was about it. In the first episode, Palmer says that even if she never got to meet Martell, she was content to honor her legacy. But then, a wonky cosmic coincidence happened. Martell broke her silence. On September the 2nd, just days after the podcast debut, she was interviewed in a Rolling Stone feature titled Country's Lost Pioneer. It's a wrenching story about a voice edged out of an industry and into silence. Palmer said she'd had no idea and said until someone sent it to her. Days later, Martell's daughter messaged Palmer to thank her for the tribute. Maybe, Palmer reasons, Martell has had enough space from the industry to finally feel free. In this, the two artists have another thing in common, Palmer says. I don't want anything from the industry. I like my career. I like the things that I do to get in a day. I like the things that I get to do in a day, and I am, this sounds cliche as hell, but I am blessed. I truly am. So I don't want anything for myself other than to be able to give opportunities to other people and to be able to continue to make music. I can say more things than people who feel like they have more to lose. Well, as usual, the Indie Week has more articles than one lone voice, even a fast reader, can get through. So I'll pick and choose, and I'll continue in the music genre from Keisha Jennings, who writes her take on Carolina hip-hop. I Can Live Without My Radio, it's titled. Former K97.5 radio personality Don Showtime Chavis reinvents himself in the midst of a pandemic. September marks the seventh month that Americans have been under some sort of stay-at-home order. COVID has led to historically high unemployment, leaving 30 million people without a steady paycheck. The forced stillness has made creatives re-envision entrepreneurship, their brands, and how they market themselves. A month before Dion Showtime Chavis got laid off from K97.5, where he was an on-air personality, the Raleigh hip-hop radio station had furloughed employees because of the pandemic. With more than 10 years of radio experience and an impressive ratings record, Chavis felt relatively safe. But the pandemic might be accelerating a pre-existing trend in radio. A recent article in the industry publication Radio World quoted a corporate executive at a major radio group. He said, "It is pretty clear that corporate radio is trending to be more centralized operations in general, similar to what iHeartMedia is doing. If anything, this pandemic proved remote operation could be achieved and much more easily than first thought. I think we will generally see facilities with fewer people and more on-air content being generated centrally instead of locally. That trend makes local independent voices like Chavis more important than ever, and while he was caught a bit off guard by the layoff, he quickly pivoted. Before he was on K97.5, he did a college radio show in Norfolk, Virginia called The Talk of the Town, which he rebooted, reuniting with the original co-host as The Talk of the Town Unfiltered, which he streams on YouTube and Facebook. So far, former No Limit Records artist Mystical and actor-comedian Jay Farrow have been featured guests. Chavis is also leading workshops on cultural competency basics to help people understand how media and pop culture influence racism and bias, and he and his wife have launched a t-shirt line that builds on their prior Black Love Brunch series. I caught up with a husband, father of two, and proud stay-at-home dad to discuss his radio journey and his impeccable hustle. And all these comments are in the form of a question and answer. What was going through your mind when K97 let you go? A part of being in this field is that you have to foresee the things that are coming. And I think it's important, particularly in a field that many folks say is dying, like radio, that you kind of look at the writing on the wall. I never wanted to be the person who was caught off guard, and then I'm left trying to figure out how to pay my mortgage. This had been on my mind for at least 5 years prior to them letting me go. Also, I wasn't passionate about it, to be honest with you. I felt like I lost my passion. I lost my fight for doing what I was doing because I'd been doing it for so long, and it just started to become redundant. Sometimes when you don't move, and it's time for you to move, God will find a way to move you. We put ourselves in these situations where we get stuck and comfortable, and then God comes along and he's like, nah, player, there's some other work for you to do. Did you have a game plan in place? No. It took me a minute to process it. Because if someone tells you that you're going to lose your main stream of income, right, your mind should automatically go to, all right, well, what am I going to do to keep food on the table? I got a wife, two kids, and a dog, and I got to be sure they're straight. I took a couple of days. I talked to my wife about it and began to process it. You know, your routine changes. I had the same routine for 5 years. You've been super productive since the layoff with the revitalization of the talk of the town. It's so crazy how things just have a way of coming full circle. The Talk of the Town was a morning show I created over 10 years ago. My co-hosts and I, Rich Girl, Dee Marie, and DJ Green, had this chemistry. When I moved here, we didn't pursue it anymore, but for the last 10 years, we have all remained in contact, even though we were pursuing different things. You know, people grow up and kind of move on with their lives. But during the pandemic, of course, everyone was in this whole let's go live thing. And, of course, DJ D. Nice set it off with the club quarantine parties he was doing. That was the inception of everyone saying, all right, let's create some content where we go live. So I reached out to all of them individually, and I said, you know, what you all think about doing a Talk of the Town reunion show? People hadn't seen us together in over 10 years. The way we ended the show was kind of abrupt back in the day. Nobody ever knew what happened. People still come up to me or hate me to this day and say, oh, I miss you all on the radio. I miss Talk of the Town. It felt like this was the perfect way to seal what our legacy was as a unit. You know what I mean? So we linked up and we did a virtual reunion show. The show was supposed to be for like an hour and ended up being like 3 hours on Facebook Live. The chemistry was still there. It was super crazy. Afterward, I say, well, what do you all think about turning this reunion into like a real thing, a real piece of content that we produced and worked on? And everyone agreed. We started doing our show every Thursday night, and the show is something that's growing organically. We started off with maybe a couple of views every Thursday, and now one of our most recent episodes, where we interviewed Mystical during the airing of the No Limit Chronicles, has 49,000 views. Well, let's keep the hits coming from the music columnists. Yair Rubenstein and Brian Howe write Roundup, and that's spelled R-A-U-N-D, Roundup. On September 4th, Roundhouse co-founder Hubble released The Plot Thickens, a gorgeous new hypnotic house single inspired by the dreary cityscapes of Glengarry Glen Ross, David Mamet's expletive-laden satire of American capitalism. The song's elegiac mood evokes desolate rain-soaked streets, abandoned storefronts, and empty subway cars. The two main ingredients are a string sample from the film's jazz noir soundtrack and a four-to-the-floor kick drum. Other than a brief half-tempo interlude, Hubble wisely restrains the song from taking too many twists and turns. Instead, he allows the groove to be patiently stretched out so we can luxuriate in its dark atmosphere. What really distinguishes The Plot Thickens are the gauzy textures Hubble wraps around the entire track. The strings sound slightly degraded, as if the producer brushed reel-to-reel tape with a few strokes of sandpaper. The low end feels distorted, not enough to overpower the mesmerizing ambience, but just enough to add a little extra unease and forward momentum. Extra dimensions of sonic decay are produced by soulful saxophone lines that dip in and out. If the Burial comparisons aren't obvious by now, Hubble still carves out a unique space in a crowded field of sonic sorcerers. The muscular, rhythmic drive of The Plot Thickens gives the song dance floor credibility. Its somber pensiveness and unrelenting bass could readily find a home, in a typical DJ set, perhaps, in that indefinable phase after the peak hour techno bangers have all been rinsed. But the melancholic comedown has yet to fully make its appearance. Of course, given the reality of our current locked-down existence, the track's dance floor readiness will remain confined to the listener's imagination. But Hubble has created a club-worthy track whose introspective melodies and distinctive textures can still be enjoyed in the discomfort of our own homes. That was from Yair Rubinstein and from Brian Howe. Guess good things do come in threes. In a mid-August, not long before local electro-poppers Body Games released an EP in retro game form, and Sylvan Esso recreated his Ferris Wheel video in Animal Crossing New Horizons, Durham beat music label Roundhouse quietly dropped Rote Foot Rocket's Black Adventure OST Adrift, its own entry into the video game. It's a soundtrack for a forthcoming Minecraft-style indie game where, apparently, you build hot air balloons to travel the distant islands. And this sense of soaring motion couldn't be a better fit for the local producer whose zeal for free running always translates into his zippy, nimble footwork and dreamy hip-hop productions. Video game music has come a long way since the bleeps and honks produced by the Nintendo Entertainment System's rudimentary 5-channel sound chip. And instead of being straightened by the form, Foot seems freed by it, unleashing an emotive, soft synth odyssey, packed with gooey melodies and punchy, propulsive rhythms. We get glassy, ambient sunrises, dewy boom-bap, yearning, wordless anthems, and blue-lit nighttime vibes, all imbued with a solitary wonder peculiar to video games. Find it and Hubbubble's new single on Roundhouse's Bandcamp page, along with another new release, On the Map. The beat tape by Bonds X Fushu is a moody take on instrumental hip-hop, as studiously classic as Foot Rocket is musically unbound. All right, backing up now to our stage, live off stage by Brian Woods. Every June, local performing arts patrons traditionally face the annual tragedy of choice, having to select a handful of shows from the flashy websites and eye-catching mailers that tease a bewildering smorgasbord of more than 200 events from regional universities and presenters. To say the least, 2020 has been different. After the pandemic wiped all live shows off the books in March, midsummer came and went with little or no word on future seasons from regional mainstays, including Carolina Performing Arts, Duke Performances, and NC State Live. Presenters' websites slipped into an eerie state of suspended animation, leaving patrons with little insight into the future. When season rollouts have taken place, they've tended to be both incremental and uncharacteristically glitchy. After Playmakers said that passes for a series of 6 virtual productions would go on sale September 1st, ticketing remained offline for 2 additional days, and the language on the company's webpage about individual and season tickets was confusing. Meanwhile, patrons may have wondered if the 5 virtual music offerings visible last week on Duke Performance's website were the only events they had on tap for the fall, or if 2 virtual coffee breaks featuring winners from the Wolfpack's Got Talent contest were the only things to come from NC State Live. But behind the disarray, as presenters try to adapt very old habits for very new worlds, frantic work has been going on to make and salvage production plans. Bobby Asher, the new director of Duke Performances, says, "The performing arts is an industry very much in crisis right now. Our entire field has been turned completely on its head." Amy Russell, director of programming at Carolina Performing Arts, cites the sudden closure last week of Columbia Artists, a 90-year-old classical music institution that represented Leonard Bernstein and Leontine Price, as evidence of the deep threat the pandemic poses to such institutions. She says, "It's just a completely different business. Overnight, you feel like you're in triage mode. What can I do? Who haven't I talked to? Who do I need to check on?" Playmakers Rep has to raise $1.5 million to cover a shortfall from canceled spring production to keep the company resilient over the next few years, according to producing artistic director Vivian Benish. Its 6-show season involves turning Paul Green Theater into something like a sound stage for live-streamed and filmed productions. The season includes 4 solo shows, starting with a remount of Kane Smiko's Temples of Lung and Air, beginning September 28. NC State Live has a different response to the financial pits. It plans to operate on virtually no revenue this year, according to director Sharon Moore. She says, "I'm not convinced we can greatly monetize live streaming of events. There's so much out there now, and it's so overwhelming." The program will continue through student fee allocations and stepped-up fundraising efforts among supporters. "We'll get through this, and the arts will still be here," Moore says. In the meantime, NC State Live will offer free online monthly happy hour presentations, in which artists can directly engage with audiences. The series begins at 5:30 p.m. on October 6th with musical excerpts and conversations with Las Cafeteras. There will also be pop-up performances by local artists, including a September 17th gig with George Hagee from Jack the Radio, for those still on campus. But Moore's most exciting initiatives are a 2-year-long social justice residencies in which cellist Shanna Tucker and choreographers Tommy Moore and Muriel Elizion will work with campus and community partners on, quote, issues of value, belonging, voice, and how bodies can tell these stories, to ask how we find a better way to live in the world going forward. At Duke Performances, Asher and colleagues have commissioned high-quality films of artists initially booked for live performances. The season begins September 12 with Ataka Quartet performing Beethoven and North Carolina composer Carolyn Shaw. Other events in jazz, dance, and world music will be announced monthly during the fall. At Carolina Performing Arts, conversations with artists and patrons about the support they need have led to 2 initiatives. Details of a live stream series of artist interviews and performances hosted by Tift Merritt will go on public on CPA's website on September 10. Why, that's tomorrow. The presenter will also sponsor 2 programs of adult online classes under the name Feedback, the Institute of Performance. The first course, starting October the 6th, deals with the element of liveness in performance. The second, beginning October 29, addresses arts economies. Tuition is free, but online registration is required. When the American Dance Festival canceled its summer season of live performances, choreographer Monica Bill Barnes had to shelve a scheduled world premiere. But the choreographer repurposes movement and interviews associated with the work in the virtual one of Keep Moving, September 30th through October 4. In the coming weeks, ADF will produce four other virtual events, including a reimagined performance of hip-hop choreographer Rennie Harris's Funkadelified. So I got that wrong, too. Funkadelified, and the premiere of a dance film by Mark Dindy and Stephen Donovan. The goal, according to Executive Director Jody Nimmerichter, is to provide, quote, a broader combination of experiences, including performances, that re-engages artists and builds platforms of collaboration across countries. That includes an international partnership between choreographer Dana Ruttenberg and Netta Yerushalmi. With each of these presenters, a shift that began in some cases years before the pandemic has picked up urgency, a change in emphasis from individual one-night performances to extended interactions between communities and creators while making work. Local presenters realize staying yoked to a professional infrastructure based on single make-or-break events leaves them vulnerable. Still to be resolved, can they devise a different model that succeeds? Well, for those of you who don't know, this program is recorded on Thursday afternoon, right after lunch hour. And so I'm happy to get enough time to look at food and drink article and maybe a couple of the best in the Triangle Awards to fill out our time. And this article is by Patty Sensenbath, owner of Yin D. Well, actually, it's by Anna Mudd, and it profiles Patty. Since opening in Morrisville's Marketplace Shopping Center in 2017, the Laotian and Thai street food restaurant Yin D has become a local favorite, with 4.5 stars on Yelp and rave reviews across various platforms. But the small family business almost had to permanently close because of the shutdown until loyal locals rallied to save it. I must be hungry. Alyssa Graham's family has been in the restaurant business for 15 years. They formerly owned Champa Thai and Sushi in Raleigh. Graham's mother, Patty Sesombath, and grandmother, Sandy Sivongsa, opened Yin D in April 2017. Nothing fancy, Sesombath says, just good food. Not long after the opening, Sivongsa passed away. Now Sesombath owns Yin D and works there, prepping, cooking, and cleaning alongside her sister, Bunet Butavong. The family's restaurants have been a huge part of Graham's life since she was a child. I've spent countless days doing homework in the office there. She says my 22nd birthday was at Yin D last year. We've done Friendsgiving there. Graham felt powerless as the summer slipped away and the restaurant bore the financial toll of the pandemic. One day in late July, her sister, Morgan Snellbaker, who works at Yin D, came home and said that their mother had told her and another employee the restaurant might have to close. Before the pandemic, Sesombath says, Yin D was thriving, but May and June brought an 80% drop in sales. They tried everything, from reducing hours to offering pre-orders. Sesombath and her god sister, also a Yin D employee, have both gone without pay since March. They've had to dip into savings to keep the business afloat. A self-proclaimed optimist, Sesombath wanted to do whatever it took to keep the business going, but shutting down seemed an inevitable point on the horizon. Desperate, Graham decided to try something new. She took her Twitter off private and typed out everything that had been happening and then pressed send. She also started a GoFundMe, unsure of what goal to set. It wasn't easy. Both Graham's and Sesombath felt reluctant to ask for help, especially when times are tough for the restaurant industry at large. Initially, Graham didn't tell her mother about the fundraising efforts. When Sesombath found out about the GoFundMe, which has raised $2,870 out of the $3,500 to date, she was moved by the support. Regular customers commented that they would make a stop soon. People from other cities shared the post, and even people from other states contributed donations. I cried, she says. It makes me want to cry now. I'm very gracious, very humbled. That will help with paying back all the credit card bills. In just a few days, Graham's post was shared and liked thousands of times, and the outpouring of support was evident at Yindi. Graham says, the parking lot was filled. It had been dead for months because of COVID-19. We were very overwhelmed in the best way. While the community support has helped, Yindi's sales are still down 50% from what they were before the pandemic. Many of its customers were office workers who were working remotely now during the pandemic. Sesam Bathu says several employees have high-risk family members, has no plans yet for full reopening. Instead, Yindi offers takeout or private dining, in which customers can rent the space and order from a set menu. They also want to get outdoor dining going in the future, for which they remain hopeful. Sesam Bath says to close, in the past 2 weeks, business has been good. I hope it keeps up. As long as I can pay rent and hopefully get back on payroll, I'll be happy. And, well, I have only time to give you a few excerpts from the Indie Week Best of the Triangle 2020, which I believe came out some weeks ago, but they're reprinting a lot of it in here, mostly food-related, it looks like, and I'll just read a few of these little items to get everybody's appetite roaring. Best Bagel in the Triangle, Monette's. Best Bakery in Durham County, Googlehoof. In Base Bakery in Orange Chatham, the Googlehoof Bake Shop again. And in Wake County, La Farm Bakery. Where's the best barbecue in Durham County? The original Q Shack. How about Orange County? Hillsborough BBQ. And in Wake County, The Pit. Best biscuits in Durham, Rise, Southern Biscuits and Righteous Chicken. In Orange County, Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen. And in Wake County, The Flying Biscuit Cafe. What's the best Bloody Mary in the Triangle? Jack Tarr and the Colonel's Daughter. And best bread in Durham County? 9th Street Bakery. How about Orange Chatham County? Weaver Street Market. And best bread in Wake County? La Farm Bakery once again. Best breakfast in Durham, Elmo's Diner. The same for Chapel Hill. And in Wake County, Big Ed's City Market. Well, for our blind and print-impaired listeners, John Federson has been reading the current issue of Indie Week. It is available also in the podcast section of our website, ncreadingservice.org. A gracious appreciation to the Montana State University Balloon Choir for our music, which brings us to what we call the goodbye segment. Goodbye.